feel free to talk to either the alumni office or myself about that. And there are sponsorships available if you're interested. Just as an introduction to Rabbi Blech, Rabbi Blech has been a Magid Shir at Yeshiva University since 1966 and was the rabbi of Young Israel of Oceanside for 37 years. In addition to his work in the rabbinate, Rabbi Blech is a prolific author of books on Judaism and on the Jewish people. He's also a highly regarded speaker who has spoken on Jewish topics to communities around the world. Rabbi Blech has written 12 highly acclaimed and best-selling books, including The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Judaism and Understanding Judaism, The Basics of Deed and Creed, which was chosen by the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations as the single best book on Judaism in our generation. Rabbi Blech's most recent book is The Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's Forbidden Messages in the Heart of the Vatican, coinciding with the 500th anniversary of Michelangelo's starting work on the frescoes of the Sistine Chapel. The book is already the subject of huge interest, discussion, and controversy. The major work proves that Michelangelo's incorporated many teachings of the Jewish Midrash and Kabbalah into the Sistine Chapel. Today, Rabbi Blech will be speaking on the hidden Jewish messages in Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel frescoes. Rabbi Blech.
Thank you so very much. I'm Benjamin Blech, 54. And the reason I say that is because it's been over 20 years since I was able to say 54. So this is an opportunity for me to identify myself in that way. I am speaking about this book. 2020, a few years ago, did a one-hour special on the book. It was on Friday night, so I'm sure you didn't see it. And Martin Bashir began the interview with me by asking a question that I've subsequently been asked many times. Sistine Chapel, what's a nice Jewish boy doing in a place like this? How did I come to write this book? And more to the point, what could I possibly know that's new about the Sistine Chapel? So allow me a few words of introduction. I was involved in an incredible story, which is a different lecture. I met with Pope John Paul II personally. I have been negotiating for the release of items that the Vatican has in their possession that belong to the Jewish people. And at one of those meetings, we were advised to bring a group of rabbis. I led a delegation of 150 rabbis. This was reported around the world. Three of us stood up in front of the Pope and gave him a bracha, according to the Gemara in Brachot, which is not only permissible but mandatory. And at that time, when these 150 rabbis were in Rome, and I was involved with bureaucratic matters, they went on a tour for the Sistine Chapel. And there is one guy there who is not only Jewish, but Orthodox. He gives the tour with the yarmulke on. He's a religious gentleman. And I didn't have the time to go on the tour with them. The rabbis came back, and how shall I put this? They were speechless. Did you ever hear of 150 rabbis speechless? And they said to me, Blech, you just missed the most incredible thing. Absolutely fascinating. We toured the chapel and we saw Michelangelo's frescoes. Did you know that Michelangelo studied Kabbalah? His tutor was Pico della Mirandola. He was adopted by Lorenzo de' Medici, Michelangelo, when he was a young boy. And the tutor that he had owned the largest library of Kabbalah in the world at the time, was deeply smitten with Jewish commentaries on Torah, shared that with Michelangelo, taught him Rashi, Midrash, some Talmud, and a great deal of Kabbalah. Michelangelo personally hated the Pope of his time, was upset with many of the doctrinary views of Catholicism at the time, and incorporated these into many of the frescoes, some as hidden messages, some quite open if you open your eyes to them. He even incorporated some Hebrew letters into the frescoes, making clear his intentions, and they began to give me some illustrations. For example, in the very famous fresco about the Garden of Eden, it's very interesting that in all of Western art, the tree of knowledge, the fruit was what? An apple. That's what everybody thinks, says. There's only one tradition that it was not an apple. In Kabbalah, there's a concept of tikkun hachet, rectifying the sin. Whenever there is potential for sin, God incorporates into that the opportunity for tikkun, for rectifying what has gone wrong. And when they ate of the tree and they realized they were naked, they then covered themselves with fig leaves. Where'd they get the fig leaves from? It was a fig tree, and Kabbalah says that. Fascinating. Michelangelo is the only one who painted the tree as a fig tree. And people have told me they take the tour with the Catholic guides. They don't mention it. They don't notice it. They have no awareness that this is a Kabbalistic concept. Anyhow, the rabbis said to this gentleman, whose name is Roy Doliner, you have to write a book. This is incredible information. And it turns out that the church, in fact, does not want the emphasis, obviously, on Judaic ideas. Why don't you write this as a book? He said, I'm not a writer. They said, the gentleman who's leading the group, Rabbi Blech, has written numerous books. Why don't you get together with him? I'm fond of saying that next to the shidduch with my wife, this is the best shidduch in history, because we got along famously, and we worked together primarily through the great gift of email, and we co-authored this book. The book is The Sistine Secrets. Let me just correct you. Sistine Secrets, Michelangelo's Forbidden Messages in the Heart of the Vatican. It is now in 26 other countries, translated into 16 other languages. I have copies in every one of the languages in which it appears: Japanese, Chinese, Portuguese, French, etc., etc. It is selling best in Rome, in Italy. Of course, Rizzoli is the publisher there, the creme de la creme of publishers, and it's now in its 12th printing. It's not doing badly here at all, and I told you 2020 had a one-hour special. We have just sold the movie rights to the book, and Emet Hashem. Don't ask me now who's going to play the role of Blech, because I'm not letting Brad Pitt or anybody else have that role. And I think the name of it is going to be The Curious Case of Benjamin Blech, right? Which is, what in the world is Benjamin Blech, rabbi, doing in the Sistine Chapel? HarperCollins put out the book. I just must show you one thing, because this is absolutely amazing, and I'm so glad you came in just to see this, gentlemen and ladies. This is the cover. You have never seen anything like this. This cover opens up and opens up and opens up, and it is the Sistine Chapel ceiling. So that's beautiful. It's incredible, right? That's the infomercial part of the talk. So let's get to topless and tell you what the church doesn't want me to tell you. You said, are you doing anything controversial? And I said, no, but I am giving you inside information, right, in Morgan Stanley. You heard it here. I just would like you to know that if you say, and people have said, not knowing that my co-author is the source of the ideas, who the is Rabbi Blech to tell us about the real secrets of the Sistine Chapel? Enrico Bruschini is the official art historian of Rome. It is his job to give a tour to every American president who comes to Rome to see the Sistine Chapel. He read the manuscript. When he did, he begged us to allow him to write the foreword for the book. And I quote this line, and I'm only doing this so that you understand that if I tell you amazing things, you say, you can't possibly be. This is Enrico Bruschini. Just as the work of Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel changed forever the world of art, so will this book change forever the way to view and above all to understand the work of Michelangelo. Wow. And when people have asked me, how could that be? It is now 500 years since Michelangelo did the work. He started in 1508. How could these secrets have gone unnoticed? First of all, the man might not have gone unnoticed. Church was not very pleased in publicizing the fact that Michelangelo, under their noses, did things they did not want him to do or to say. Second, in all this time, people who were interested in art and Michelangelo and Sistine Chapel were not knowledgeable in Kabbalah. People who were knowledgeable in Kabbalah didn't care too much about the Sistine Chapel and Michelangelo. This is really the first opportunity for these two scholarly venues to come together. So let me begin the actual discussion by telling you that Michelangelo did not want to do this job of the frescoes in the Sistine Chapel. The Pope, Julius II, came to him and said, "You're doing it." He said, "I am not a painter." Michelangelo was a sculptor. He signed, whenever he signed, Michelangelo, the sculptor. The Pope said, "You're doing it. You'll learn. You are talented enough. You can do this." He commissioned him in particular to do this in honor of his family and to the glory of Pope Julius II, and dedicated to Jesus and the Virgin Mary. That was his commission. When he got finished, 4.5 years later, there was not a single specific Christian reference. 95% of that Sistine Chapel ceiling, 4 million people a year go to see it, most visited art museum in the world. 95% of it is, forgive the expression, but it's the only way I can make it clear, is Old Testament. We hate the term, I'm just saying it so that you understand, is the Jewish Bible. And 5% is pagan. 95% Old Testament Jewish, 5% pagan. How the heck did he get away with it? When Michelangelo took the job, he made one condition. He told the Pope, "All right, I'll do it. I have no choice. I cannot take instructions or criticism or advice." He said to him, "Gimme nishken etzes." He didn't say that in Yiddish, but I'm translating for him. "Please don't give me advice." And 62.5 feet up in the air, he built a scaffolding that, by the way, nobody could figure out how he was able to do, an engineering feat on its own, and underneath it put a canvas, ostensibly not to let the paint go down, fall on people, but it served a much more important purpose for him, and that is during the work, nobody could see what he was doing. Gets finished, and as I said to you, 95% old, 5% pagan, and it did not fulfill the commission. It didn't do what the Pope told him to do. So how did he get away with it? If you take a look at the bottom of the first page, if you go to the Sistine Chapel today, you don't come in the entrance that was the entrance originally. The entrance was where this painting, fresco, appeared over the head of the entryway. And it was a painting of Zechariah. These were identified, by the way, so it's not a guess. The prophet Zechariah. Very strange that Michelangelo should pick a prophet who is not among the greats. Who would you have expected? Who were the really great prophetic names? Jeremiah, Isaiah, etc., etc. Zechariah? Why do you pick Zechariah? We'll get to that in a moment. The first thing the Pope noticed when he looked at Zechariah is the reason why Michelangelo was still alive after he did the job. Because the face of Zechariah was nothing other than a portrait of the face of Julius II, the Pope who commissioned him. And Michelangelo said, "You asked me to do this in honor of Jesus, but Jesus still lives today in you, your glory, your excellency," whatever he called them. "You represent Jesus today." Julius II was an egomaniac. And, by the way, he was also someone who Michelangelo detested because of his immorality. He had syphilis contracted from mistresses. was lusted after money, terrible, terrible person. How the church deals with that in their terms is their problem. But Michelangelo paints Zechariah, puts Pope Julius II's face on Zechariah, chooses Zechariah, we believe, for a number of reasons. We just did the Haftorah of Zechariah this past Shabbat. Zechariah is known for one phrase, which I'm sure Michelangelo intended as a little shtuch, a little message to the Pope. What is the most famous phrase from Zechariah? Lo b'chayav lo b'koach kim beruchi amar Hashem. The Pope had previously asked Michelangelo to do a sculpture of him which would grace the entrance to the city of Bologna. And when Michelangelo had asked him, how do you want me to portray you? Very often they would be portrayed with a book indicating scholarship. He said, me, I am not a scholar, Pope had said. I am a man of the sword. Put him with a sword. Lo b'chayav lo b'koach kim beruchi amar Hashem. Zechariah is the one who said that because of the corruption of the Kohanim, the spiritual leaders, the enemy will come from the north to attack and destroy the people and the temple. And he was saying this to the Pope as well. Because of corruption of spiritual leadership, you will be destroyed. To make clear his feelings, he did something which was not visible to the eye from down below. Today, with the photography that we have, and you will appreciate the line in a moment, the digital photography that we have, we can spot something, a little message that Michelangelo incorporated as well, via the two angels over the head of Zechariah. These are cartoonish figures that are used throughout to represent an idea that the artist wanted to get across. And you see that one, the one on your right, has his hand over his fellow angel. And his hand is in a certain position. Now, I don't know if you know this. In America today, of course, we express contempt also digitally with a middle finger. In Europe to this very day, they do it differently. There is an expression, if you know Yiddish, ich feig auf dir, which means I give you the fig. And the fig is done this way, with the thumb like this, like so. And believe it or not, when you blow this up, when you see it carefully, and don't forget, this then was over the head of the Pope as he entered the Sistine Chapel. The angel right behind the Pope. The Pope, I say the Pope because Zechariah has the face of the Pope, is actually giving him the finger. And that is digital photography, right? That's incredible. And that is a message. Now, if you turn the page for a moment, he did something quite similar with an even stronger message on the painting, the fresco of Aminadav. I had mentioned to you just a few moments ago that Enrico Bruschini was very taken with the novel ideas. And we asked him, which idea struck you the most? What really sold you on what we were saying? And he said, what you recognized, realized, and wrote about, got to Aminadav. So that's what I'm going to tell you next. Now, there is a section of the ancestors Michelangelo painted, aside from the major middle row. Aminadav is not a major figure by far. As a matter of fact, if I ask you, who was Aminadav? I always do this, and invariably there is one person at least, there are a couple sometimes, who know him, but not by way of himself, but rather by way of his son. His son was Nachshon ben Aminadab. Nachshon was the one who, when the Jews were standing at the sea, what are we going to do? And God, of course, says, trust me. But the way to trust God is you have to go as far as you can go into the raging waters. Just believe. And it was not like Cecil B. DeMille portrayed it in the movie, that the waters simply split when they were standing at the shore. They had to make a move, and they went until the neck. Nachshon went in first, and when they went as far as they could go, a beautiful concept, when you go as far as you can go, then God takes over. So Nachshon is a great guy. I mean, Aminadab, okay, father of. And pick him. There are very few ancestors who are chosen for this great distinction to be painted Michelangelo. Why did he pick Aminadab? Before I give you the answer, I'd like you to take a look at Aminadab's arm, and your right, his left. You know that for years, the frescoes had been dulled by age, but there was restoration that brought back the brilliant, vivid colors in 2000-2001. It was completed, and we could again see something that had been part of this fresco. On the left hand of Aminadab, right to you, there is a yellow band, a yellow circle. You see it. It had not been clear for quite a while. What is that circle? In 1215, the Lateran Council of the Church passed a law. The Jews were required to wear a yellow armband as a sign of disgrace. Shades of Nazi Germany, the yellow star. The Nazis were not the ones who invented this. Truth be told, the church didn't invent it either. This goes back to Muslims who made prostitutes wear a yellow band of some kind, yellow symbol of urine and hence of degradation. It was the church, though, who initiated a yellow band of some kind as a specific form of degradation for Jews. Aminadab was chosen by Michelangelo because of his name. Aminadab means prince of my people. Ami, my people, Nadab, prince. That is a term by which the church designates and designated Jesus. Aminadab, prince of my people, is a stand-in for Jesus, who is wearing a yellow armband, because Michelangelo, who was, and we know this from many other sources, deeply distressed by the persecution of Jews, by the anti-Semitism of the church in that time. We're talking about 1508. You know when the Jews were expelled from Spain, 1492. You know the time frame in general. He is saying, if Jesus were alive today, you would be forcing him to wear a yellow armband of disgrace and contempt. Aminadab. Wow, what a message. And if I can, just on the theme, jump for a moment to yet another page, one more. I'm sorry.
Just one quick question, I'm sorry to interrupt. Just for clarification, the way that these figures are the people in the Bible.
He identified them. There's a plaque.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you turn the page. I tell you a detail from the Last Judgment. Let me just make clear in your own mind. The Last Judgment was not part of the Sistine Chapel ceiling frescoes. 24 years after he finished his job, he thought he was done. They called him back and they said, you're doing the wall. He said, the wall is done already. They said, yeah, not with the Michelangelo. And they insisted, they forced him to do the wall. And this time, because of the experience that they had previously, and they knew that he hadn't fulfilled his commission, they said, and you're doing the wall, and you're doing it the way we're telling you to do it. And they watched him every moment, and they said to him, you are doing the Last Judgment, and you are doing Jesus, which he had to do. But he snuck in something else again, on the theme that has special relevance to us as Jews and special relevance today in the aftermath of a huge controversy that is roiling the evangelical movement today and was the theme of a cover story in Time magazine a month and a half ago and the theme of an article in USA Today a few weeks ago by myself. And that is, he, in this Last Judgment, Michelangelo, did the circle of the righteous. Jesus is in the middle. The snippet that you have here is not arranged in the way in which I just wanted to get a portion of it that's here. But Jesus is in the middle. He's the focus. And round about him, the circle of the righteous, are the people sharing eternity with Jesus because of their righteousness. And the first simple idea that he was getting across is, and the righteous are people who could be modest, not famous. I mean, it's a Hasidic idea, right? The good people, the good plain people. In the corner, top, and I'll show you where to look in a moment, he snuck in two guys who don't belong there based on Catholic theology. Because in strict Catholic theology, the only way in which someone can be saved eternally, get into heaven, is by belief in Jesus. If you don't believe in Jesus, you are damned. It was just recently that Pastor Bell caused this huge controversy, and the book is now number one on the bestseller list, where he says that it's impossible for him to believe that a God of love would condemn to hell someone like Gandhi, and he picks Gandhi and then some other people. How could you say that these people, just because they didn't believe in Jesus, are doomed to hell? So it is conceivable to get to heaven even without Jesus. And for this, he was excommunicated by many, and again, there's this controversy. If you will take a look. Now, how can I get you to look at this exactly? Top row, to the right, as far as you can go, the very top row, there are two figures. One of them is wearing a blue hat. The other is wearing a yellow hat. Do you see them? Yes? Yes. The blue hat was known as a Jew hat. It had two spaces like this for the horns of Jews. On the right, there's the guy with a yellow hat. Again, the urine. The guy with the blue hat is lifting up his hand, one finger. That is the exact way in which Michelangelo painted Noah in another fresco previously on the ceiling, where Noah was saying there is one God. Here is a man who believes in one God, not three, and he is in heaven next to Jesus. That could have gotten him, should have gotten him condemned. How he got away with this one is incredible, but Michelangelo stuck two Jews into the circle of the righteous. Go back to the previous page. One more thing about Aminadab. I've been telling you about fingers and digital concepts. Do you notice something else? The Pope sat right under Aminadab. Can you tell me what you see in the fingers of Aminadab? That's universal. The kids do it to this day. They go behind somebody's back and they go like this. Devil's horns. Like this. Devil's horns. And here is Aminadab, just a little like this. Devil's horns. Wow. There it is. If you turn the page again, Jeremiah is big. Jeremiah is the prophet of destruction. Jeremiah, you see his name there? Spelled Jeremias. On his shoulders, each of his soldiers, there are two figures, one in red, one in yellow. Red and yellow to this day are the colors of Rome. You take a taxi cab in Rome, they are red and yellow. Rome. Jeremiah, look at his face. It is the face of destruction. These two figures, the red, what is she wearing? Ready to hit the road. Ready to hit the road, right? There, bundle up, going to be leaving. you're going to be exiled. Just as the Jews were told by Jeremiah because of corruption, because of their sins, so too to the church. And the one in yellow, in order for you to get the message, is looking where? Down. Down to where? Down to a scroll. Do you see the scroll? Do you see it? Yes, yes or no? Please speak up. This is a dialogue. A scroll, thank you. Now, what does it say on the scroll? People have taken the tour with the Catholic eyes, and they told me it's just a squiggle. It's just a squiggle. Turn back. We blew it up. Turn back a page. Previous. Detail from the Jeremiah panel. My God, it actually says something. Can you read it? A-L-E-F. What is that? Aleph. And what else? And then a Hebrew letter. Ayin. Oh my God, Aleph, Ayin. Aleph is what? Who knows one? I know one. One is our God. One God. 70. Who knows the meaning? Kabbalah? You don't need heavy Kabbalah. Everybody should know this. Shivim umot ha'olam, the 70 nations of the world. One God. The concept of universalism, which was taught to Michelangelo by Pico, his teacher, his Rebbe, the concept of a universal God as opposed to exclusionary concept, philosophy of the church, the theology of the church at the time, was something that Michelangelo absorbed and was saying here as well. There is one God for the 70 nations, fantastic, which is why on the first page, when Michelangelo did the frescoes, and he's supposed to do this for the Virgin Mary, and Jesus doesn't do Christian figures. He does the first two chapters, the first two sedras of Bereshit. Of Bereshit. He does creation, and he begins with the creation of Adam. This is probably the most famous painting in the world, next to the Last Supper and the Mona Lisa, probably. This is famous. Well, what's the point of this? What year are we in? We live in this world. We can't help it. So you're going to tell me we're in 2011. Why is it 2011? Anytime you do this, you are using a date based on a Christian concept. We have no choice. I try to do 5, 7, 6. They bounce the checks. But it is 2011 from Jesus. Because anything before Jesus is irrelevant. Anything before Jesus doesn't matter. Not universalistic from creation, even from their terms, disagree as to how old the earth is and give us a year that indicates when mankind was born. No, it's a Jesus from Jesus. Everything else is meaningless. Wow. And here we are, Michelangelo, doing creation. Adam, Eve, doing the story of creation as recorded in the Torah. He does creation, I guess next to last thing I can say. I know time is money here, and I'm supposed to finish. I'll finish in 3 minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah,
let me finish. I have stuff to go, but I got to be bound by time. There is God surrounded by some kind of cape. What is he doing in that cape, and what is that cape? I want to tell you, before Blech and Dolina, that's called BBD, right? There already was a Jewish doctor. That's probably being repetitious, right? A Jewish doctor. A doctor who went to the Sistine Chapel, and he had an idea, and his insight that was published and is now accepted in the art world by everybody. Incredible. And it comes from a Jewish doctor, as I said. He looked at this and said, what in the world is God on the right, representation of God, creating Adam, doing in this cape kind of a thing? What is it? And he blacked out the colors, and he said to himself, this is an illustration from Bio 101. And he determined that what this was a cross-section of the brain. Of the brain with the ganglia, right side of the brain, there it is. That is the brain. And what is the idea? Something, again, that's being thought about today. It's a huge controversial issue. Creation, intelligent creation, creation by design, creation with the mind of God, as opposed to accidents. He had more in mind. Michelangelo knew Kabbalah, and I don't know if you are aware of it, when, if you are observant, and you know the law, and you go to the bathroom, yes, there's a blessing for a sewing machine, and there's a blessing for leaving the bathroom. Asher yotzar et, not Adam, but ho-Adam b'chokhmah, based on a Kabbalistic concept that God created the Adam, Adam 1, with wisdom. In the Kabbalistic sphere, mankind was created with wisdom. And there he is. There is the God in the brain creating Adam. Turn to page 2. Almost finished. The most outstanding figure in the entire work is Jonah. Jonah is not the most outstanding prophet, but he is the most outstanding. By outstanding, I mean it in terms of size and in terms of what Michelangelo did with Jonah. This, if you're there, actually looks three-dimensional. You cannot believe it is not three-dimensional, and even on the page here, it looks three-dimensional. See it? That means it's outstanding. Why was he so concerned with Jonah? What's the big deal with Jonah? Again, not a huge prophet. Huge for us in what way? When do we read Jonah? End of Yom Kippur. Jonah was forced to prophesy to the Gentiles. Michelangelo was forced to do his job, this job. This is the last thing he did to the Gentiles. He preached, and at first he believed. There's no point to it. They're not going to do tshuva, but they did. Michelangelo identified with Jonah. Jonah was his alter ego. Michelangelo twice ran away in the middle of the job, just as Jonah did. And they caught him and brought him back. There's no fish and no belly, but other than that, comparable. Incredible. Michelangelo, Jonah. And you see the angel on top? What's he holding up? His hand. What do you see? Five fingers. Wow. Always look for the angels. They're the commentary. Five fingers. And then there's the angel below who's looking at the legs of Jonah. Right? The legs of Jonah are made to appear like a Hebrew letter. You will notice that in front of Jonah's genitalia, there is a shmata. And you might say that that shmata is there so that you don't get a wiener, right? That didn't get a response at all? Nothing? Oh my God, what's wrong here? Michelangelo painted nudes all the time, even on the ceiling. Later on, they hired somebody to cover him up. He had no hesitation in representing male genitalia. This is the only time he covered it up, the only time. In order to get that little cover, which then makes the legs go like so, please look at my hand, like so and so, which is a hey. This, this, and this. The guy on top, five. Then this guy, a hey. Who knows five? I know five. Michelangelo again saying, get back to your roots. Get back to the roots of Christianity, which are the five books of Moses. And is that all you have? Is that, let me see. Yeah. By a fortuitous coincidence, which I don't believe is a coincidence, because as the saying goes, coincidence is God's way of choosing to remain anonymous. Michelangelo dies, and the church was aware, we now know, that in many different ways Michelangelo was trying to show them up and did not believe traditional Christianity, and therefore they buried him disrespectfully in an out-of-the-way place in Rome. The people in Florence was furious because this was their idol, this was their great hero. They said, you can't do this to our men. And so they did something very Jewish, people of Florence. They made an appeal. And does no one smile here? Is there something wrong early in the morning? Oh, Morgan Stanley, you were talking about the market opening right away. Right? Okay. So they said, we're going to raise money to hire the two best ganovim, the two best thieves, steal the body of Michelangelo, bring him back to Florence where we can give him a decent and a coveted resting place. And they did, and they hired these two guys, and they were successful. They got the body out. This is going to be a great part in the movie, and the scenes with the carriage, and Michelangelo with the coffin hidden in straw, etc. They bring him back to Florence, and they bury him in Santa Croce, most magnificent church. In 1850, that church decides it needs to renovate. And they look for an architect, and the best architect, of course, was Jewish. They come to this guy, Matas, and they say, we want you to do a new facade. And he says, I'll be happy to do it. One thing, whenever I do a piece of work, I have to sign my name. They said, no Jew will ever have his name in front of the church. They argued back and forth. Finally, they compromised. And the compromise was he couldn't sign his name, but he could have a big Magen David on top, which is why to this very day, when you go to the burial place of Michelangelo and the church of Santa Croce, there is a huge Magen David on top. So God had his way, I think, of saying, this man, revered by the church, nonetheless, to some extent. Now, I don't oversell. People ask me afterwards, Rabbi Blech, are you saying that Michelangelo was Jewish? No, that he had a neshama that at least was sensitive to Jewish concerns, aware of Kabbalah, and the Magen David is the most Kabbalistic of signs, up and down, mala, amata, and so on, and that should be over his resting place is a magnificent closing to the theme that there are fantastic Jewish themes in the Sistine Chapel. Of course, I only gave you a very small taste, so you will have to buy the book. Please do so afterwards. Amazon, any place, Barnes & Noble. Thank you very much.
I guess we can take a few questions. We're into a couple questions.
If you have the time, I don't know. I thought it was very constrained. Fine.
Rabbi, you gave a convincing talk about the Jewish subtext in my Barnes & Noble. Couldn't a convincing case be made for gay subjects?
For what?
For gay. I mean, Michelangelo.
Gay of it. Yes, absolutely. Michelangelo was gay himself, and there were many times when he tried to indicate, both by way of his great love for the human body, which, by the way, is one of the reasons he was taken by Kabbalah, because the concept of God being both masculine and feminine, and the concept of the glorification of sex in Kabbalah, God being the joining of the two, and many, many sexual ideas in Kabbalah appeal to him greatly. And yes, you are quite correct. Being gay himself and knowing of the anathema of the church to gays to this very day, he wanted in some way to plead his case. You're right. Yes? Correct. Two things. Number one, I am not a posek, and I will allow you to be personally guided by whichever posek you want. I will tell you, as you've indicated, there is great machlokas, the machlokas being rooted in the fact that it is no longer used for masses. It is a museum. I will tell you that my co-author has given a tour to Kol Olim from Israel, to Russia Yeshiva, etc., most of whom do not want their names mentioned in that regard. So there is a fear, and there is this whole attitude of, I don't want right-wingers to pick on me, and again, and they may be right for all you know. And if people really press me against the wall, I have to tell you, the most incredible thing, and I'm not saying this to be defensive, I'm simply responding in truth. I did not go to the Sistine Chapel that day, and subsequently I came back and we did all this work by email, so I wasn't even there, but I know all of this from pictures. I would go, if you ask me honestly, and nobody says you have to go, and before you make up your mind, go and ask your local rabbi. Yes?
If the church is so opposed to the work that it was doing, you know, after he finished it, and they actually saw everything, why did they keep it? Or if it was so opposed to what they had in mind?
The response was so incredible. People loved it so much, they had an easier way to deal with it, and that was to reinterpret. And to reinterpret was to say that everything there is a prefiguration of Jesus and was meant to allude to Jesus and was a symbol of Jesus. Although we are quite certain, and we think we can prove, Dolan or I, that they knew he did a job on them.
And is that the position still today?
What?
Is that the church's position still today, or today sort of admit to the Old Testament nature? It's hard not to.
They're not too happy with this book and the revelations. And we know what they tell their guides to say. Guides who have been taught the spiel, the regular spiel, follow Dolan around to listen to what he has to say. I can only tell you, see, it's not being immodest because it's not me. I can talk about Dolan there. But this is a man, my co-author, who has dedicated his life. The last 15, 20 years, he's been there. He lives in Rome. He has studied. Now he's beginning to write other books himself. And he is gaining a huge reputation. He has been invited by Yale University to lecture on this book in the fall. Yes?
Well, following up on what this gentleman asked, I guess, why did they call him back 24 years later to do the last judgment if they weren't satisfied? That's the first question. The second is...
Let me answer that. Because he was Michelangelo, and they were going to watch him carefully. And for some of the work that he did on top, they at first wanted immediately to deface it and to alter it. They couldn't figure out a way to do the scaffolding. When eventually they did, they had somebody paint over at least the nudes and the genitalia.
In the Last Judgment, I think that's what we saw later too.
I'm sorry?
The wall,
they had him, and there was nothing he could do, and he had to follow instructions.
They painted some nudes, and it was later covered up.
Oh, the wall, they also did changes, yes.
Was it a different pope at that point?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Could you, what do you make of Jonah's hands? What's he pointing to, and what's he doing?
I didn't have time to do that. That's all in the book. Jonah is pointing away from the pope towards the heavens. Now, the pope is supposed to be the dove of God. Jonah is dove. Translation of Jonah is dove. Here is the real Jonah pointing away from his face away from the Pope towards the heavens.
But the shape of the hands, does it mean anything to
you? Or not to me, no.
What does Amin Adab looking at? He's looking sort of aside, it looks like.
Which one?
Amin Adab. He seems to be looking to the right.
No, Amin Adab is just, he is painted as very sad because of the history of his people, and if we take it more clearly with regards to what's on his arm, with regard to what his people have been subjected to.
Thank you.
All right, Bob, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And thanks everyone for coming. The next year will be July 12th or 13th. We'll send out an email about that with Rabbi Neuberger. So I hope everyone can make it. And if you're interested in sponsoring a portion or a full year, please feel free to contact the alumni office or myself. Have a good day.
Do you know the process in Alaska, the process in
yes.